Making engaging literacy activities, focusing on Somali elementary school students at Northside Learning Center. To begin, I'd like to give a brief overview of the Somali refugee crisis. Somalia's refugee crisis began over two decades ago with state collapse and civil war. This, compounded with natural disasters, drought, and famine, the presence of Al-Shabaab, and the general lack of basic services, has made life in Somalia incredibly difficult. The UN estimated that by 2018, 2 million people would be internally displaced in Somalia by both conflict and famine. But many also go to Kenya, to Kakuma Refugee Camp or Dadaab Refugee Complex, which, as of August 2017, hosted almost 200,000 and 212,000 registered refugees and asylum seekers, respectively. Hundreds of thousands of Somalis are spread across Kenya, Ethiopia, Djibouti, and Yemen. Despite the persistence of insecurity and instability in Somalia, however, countries like Kenya have been pushing, with the support of the UN, to close their camps and repatriate Somalis. Decades of conflict have severely negatively impacted childhood access to education in Somalia. Just 30% of children are estimated to be enrolled in primary school, and of that 30%, just 40% are girls. For rural households, only 18% of children are enrolled, and of pastoralists, who account for 65% of the population, just 22% of children are enrolled in formal school. The enrollment of girls is consistently lower than that of boys, and just 25% of women ages 15 to 24 were literate, according to a nationwide survey done in 2006. School costs money, and poverty is the main reason why children are not enrolled. This lack of enrollment means schools have almost no funding to cover costs of running. Many children in Somalia also begin school much later than the recommended age of 6. In Somaliland and Puntland, there are significant numbers of children ages 14 to 17 attending primary school. In Dadaab Refugee Complex, education covers preschool, primary, secondary, adult literacy, special education, vocational training, and scholarships for tertiary education. In the complex, there are 22 primary schools, 9 secondary schools, 4 vocational training centers, 3 adult literacy centers, and 3 libraries. There are also a number of private schools and several religious schools. As of September 2019, more temporary schools were being put up as a result of the recent influx of refugees. Schools follow the Kenyan curriculum. There are 970 teachers, and just 186 of them are trained, with 420 more enrolled in a one-year in-service training program. To reach 100% enrollment and a 1 to 45 classroom ratio, about 75 new schools are needed. There is a significant lack in books and teaching materials, and student performance is low. There is increased demand for school as the United Nations raises awareness about the importance of education, but many students drop out or have to repeat primary school, further increasing demand on classrooms. As of the United Nations 2011 education briefing, for pre- and primary school-age children, just 33% of girls were enrolled and 49% of boys, for a total of 42% of all children ages 5 to 13 in the camp. In secondary school, enrollment is even lower. For ages 14 to 17, just 5% of girls and 14% of boys are enrolled, for a total of 10% of that age group. In Kakuma Refugee Camp, access to education is also limited. Schools and resources are far past capacity, with a classroom ratio of 1 to 156, a bathroom to child ratio of 1 to 141, desks at 1 to 9, and teachers at 1 to 97. Though school is free in Kakuma, there is still the cost of school supplies, transport, uniforms, and sometimes bribery. There is also a loss of income. Children in school cannot earn through menial labor or care for their siblings while parents work. Less than 50% of teachers hold proper qualifications. The total gross enrollment as of the last report was 47,798, but the total number of children ages 5 to 17 in Kakuma is 74,067. The majority have either no schooling or interrupted schooling, preventing the completion of primary school. Refugees resettled in Syracuse, New York, typically end up enrolled in the Syracuse City School District. According to 2019 data from the New York State Education Department, for grades 3 through 8 out of 1,538 English language learners tested for ELA proficiency in 2019, 3% of students scored as proficient in the Syracuse City School District. For 7,214 economically disadvantaged students, 14% scored as proficient. In mathematics proficiency tests, 5% of 1,605 English language learners earned proficient scores, and 12% of 6,949 economically disadvantaged students scored as proficient. Data for all students was not much better. As compared to schools in Dadaab and Kakuma, the student-teacher ratio in SCSD is 13 to 1, with 21,245 students and 1,594 teachers. The district has approximately $21,000 of funding per student. Other than high levels of poverty, another major challenge faced by the district is that of its funding. While schools in wealthier neighborhoods draw heavily on local funding, SCSD draws the majority of its funding from the state. SCSD also has the highest suspension rate out of all of New York's traditional school districts. Teachers are often not certified or well-prepared to work with students in the district. Syracuse itself and parts of SCSD are dangerous. The Syracuse crime rate is 42.92 per 1,000 residents, one of the highest in the nation. Beyond that, anecdotally, students cite incidents of racially targeted bullying and poorly behaved classmates as negatively impacting their time in school. Most of the students come from large families, with as many as 10 siblings, and sometimes more. Culturally, these children tend to take on more responsibility for providing care in the family than their American peers, especially the girls. It is also not uncommon for children of refugees to serve as translators for their parents in a variety of serious formal contexts, as they have better access to English education. There are many struggles that are unique to the resettled refugee, but in Syracuse, New York, those challenges often come with the burden of poverty, underfunded schools, and dangerous neighborhoods. In short, students leave one challenging learning environment just to enter another. In a world where STEM skills are increasingly valued and emphasized, it is important to not leave literacy development behind. If students wish to pursue higher education and skilled labor, they are going to have to read and write effectively. Realistically, as students progress in their academic careers, every discipline is going to require the ability to read critically and comprehend, as well as write to explain work. Literacy is important not just in academics, but for socioeconomic success as well. Countless studies have made it common knowledge that improving literacy skills helps to eliminate extreme poverty and to break the intergenerational poverty cycle. If there is one skill that underlies almost every aspect of academic and career success in America, it is English literacy. As one Syracuse City School District math teacher noted, while he has really sharp students in class, they are lost when they get to word problems. His advice to them is to stick with the numbers in the problem and guess between multiplication and division, as in the third grade state test, it's almost always one of those. This, of course, will not hold for the rest of their academic and social careers. In my experience helping ELL students with reading and writing at Northside Learning Center, I have seen a common thread of frustration and lack of interest. For refugees who are learning not only English, but also how to read and write, there is the frustration of learning a new and difficult task and the frustration of feeling stupid when they cannot express themselves in English the way they can in their native language or understand English the way they understand their native language. It is well documented that reading books, especially storybooks for children, has a dramatic impact on robust vocabulary acquisition. This suggests that one of the most effective ways to increase English vocabulary and improve self-expression is to read English books. But this is easier said than done. Older students express embarrassment at having to read books meant for children in order to read at their level, as well as a general disinterest in the books themselves. This raises a challenge to find books that are interesting to an older audience, but written for a beginning reader. It is important to keep frustration in mind when planning an appropriate reading activity for English language learners. If it is going to be fun and engaging, it can't be overly difficult. Interest is a little more complicated than frustration, so I will paint a picture of it anecdotally. Everyone in the classroom speaks English quite well. There are really no obvious deficiencies in speaking or listening that I have experienced. This is perhaps what caused me the most surprise when I sat down with one of the children to read. Reading had been her idea, we picked a book off the shelf and got to it. English spelling is not phonetic, and pronunciation is not always obvious. Words which she comfortably used in speaking, such as though, enough, and through, proved incredibly difficult to read off the page. The student I sat down with is in fifth grade and clearly quite bright. She's one of the best in the class at spelling and very good at math. Reading out loud and writing are another story. Beyond the difficulty of decoding words she so often used in speaking, it was also clear that the book was not of much interest to her. We tried a few typical American children's books, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Judy Moody, Harry Potter, but nothing really seemed to pique her interest. It occurred to me that while we were reading, each story was probably somewhat foreign to her, not just in language, but in culture. The stories, even whimsical Harry Potter, assume a background of typical Western culture in terms of small middle-class families, English names, weather, schools, religion, clothes, food, and more. Harry Potter is, of course, more British than American, but it's not much of a cultural leap, even with magic involved. We paused at unknown vocabulary and concepts, and the frequent interruption made the story hard to follow. I found myself much in the same situation helping another younger girl with her homework. Though she could read the words, the names of the characters, two sisters called Danica and Leanna, were a far cry from those she is most familiar with, and tripped her up. Beyond the names, the story mentions one of the sisters being a frequent cross-country trophy winner, and then in a post-reading question, asks what sport that girl was good at. The story never goes on to explain what cross-country is, or even explicitly state that it is a sport. Cross-country was not a part of this particular student's cultural vocabulary. Upon arrival, students have to learn two languages, that of English and that of American culture. It seems as though there often is an implicit assumption that these are the same thing, and they are not. Try dropping an American in Scotland or the United Kingdom. When we present students with stories like the aforementioned, we assume knowledge of cultural concepts and vocabulary. Knowing the words cross and country really won't get a student any closer to knowing what cross-country is without explanation, especially if they have no cultural equivalent in their experience. We present not just unfamiliar language, but an unfamiliar world attached to it. It seems as though this confounding of English and culture is all too often overlooked. Nowhere in these assignments are there young Muslim girls with large families who eat sambusas, wear the hijab, aren't middle class, and love soccer. It seems to me that it is far more difficult to understand a new language when it is presented in the context of a new and unfamiliar world than if it is presented in familiar terms. The students have to learn both English and America, but perhaps they will learn them better if they are not taught as one. In researching for this project, I found that even books aimed at a diverse ELL audience fail to take into account the actual experience many of these girls have. Some stories seemed more targeted at creating understanding in young American audiences. Drita, My Homegirl, by Jenny Lombard, is a story about an unlikely friendship between a popular fourth grader named Maxie and the new girl Drita, a refugee from Kosovo. And Last Stop of Market Street, by Matt De La Pena, features a young child asking his grandmother questions about disability and poverty on their way to volunteer at a soup kitchen after church. There are a number of books about the Hispanic experience and various Asian experiences and African-American experiences, but very few for diverse African refugees, especially Muslims. A book called I'm New Here by Anne Sibley O'Brien features three students who are immigrants from Guatemala, Korea, and Somalia who struggle with expressing themselves in English in their new American school. But this book assumes that the students receive a great deal of support and encouragement from their peers and teachers to help them overcome this. As previously addressed, in the Syracuse City School District, this is fairly unrealistic. The schools are underfunded, teachers are overburdened, and kids can be mean. The idea that every child will be welcomed with open arms to a safe and capable school environment is unfortunately somewhat inaccurate. Another book, Color of Home by Mary Hoffman, is specifically about a young Somalian refugee, but it features violent scenes which may trigger students in an inappropriate way for a classroom setting, and again assumes that teachers at school have time to extend special attention to new children. While these books may be more representative than typical American children's literature, I think accurately depicting the refugee experience of America matters too. These children face adversity upon arrival, and reading about characters who face and overcome similar challenges would again be more representative and probably more impactful than reading about characters who do not. The incorporation of movement into the classroom is increasingly shown to be beneficial to student learning. Research has provided a significant amount of evidence in favor of incorporating movement breaks in 15-minute increments for students to learn most effectively. The neurological basis for this lies partially in the hippocampus, which is responsible for short-term memory and its integration into long-term memory. Providing a movement break gives the hippocampus time to process class material, which improves retainment of information. When students return to content, they can refocus more easily. Movement can also be used socially and to re-energize. In schools where children don't have recess, such as Franklin Elementary in SCSD, incorporating movement into class time gives kids much-needed physical activity that they can't always get otherwise in their school day. Aside from movement breaks, physical activity can also be integrated with teaching content. Movement promotes mental clarity by increasing blood flow to the brain, and children who are more active have been shown to exhibit better focus, faster cognitive processing, and better information retention than children who spend the day sitting still. Small ways to integrate movement with regular classroom activity include having students bring their assignments to the teacher, as opposed to having them collected while sitting still, and having students form groups to work on lesson questions, and then having them write answers on the board. For English language learners specifically, during lessons that focus on vocabulary, total physical response has been shown to be highly effective with both children and adults to learn new words. Total physical response is quite simple. Have students act out physical gestures to represent vocabulary words. Another strategy is snapshot, in which students create a physical snapshot to represent an idea. This is also similar to the idea of physically simulating ideas and concepts. Songs with movement are another creative way to help students remember information. There are many free online resources that present ideas and lesson plans for incorporating movement into content. These ideas of culturally representative literature and movement in learning were the motivation for developing a joint movement and literacy activity. The activity I created, with help from the classroom teacher Hamdi Farah, involved reading a story out loud and performing physical actions on target words in the story. In selecting a story, I had two major criteria: cultural representation and a scary theme. I wanted a book that the Somali girls could connect with, and I wanted something scary. The girls have repeatedly expressed fascination with scary things, demons, witches, monsters, and the like, and I wanted to find a story that would capture those interests. The story I used was Degder, a scary Somali folktale retold by Marianne A. Hassan and illustrated by Betsy Bowen. This book comes from the Somali Bilingual Book Project. For target words and physical activities, I selected words that were repeated frequently throughout the text: Degder, the name of the witch, woman, and run. I wanted to keep the number of target words minimal so that students would not be worried about remembering word-action pairings, but frequent so that actions would change quickly and attention to the story would be encouraged. For Degder, students had to do their best witch impression. For woman, they had to balance on one foot until they heard another target word. For run, they had to run in place. I chose doing your best witch impression because it seemed like something that would be fun and followed the theme of the story. I chose balancing on one foot because it gets kids hopping around and giggling. I chose running in place because it served to act out the story, but also to burn more energy than other activities might. Students responded really well to the activity, and according to Hamdi, told their friends who had missed it all about it the next time they had class. They were extremely excited to see Somali language and Islam in the text, literally clambering around the book when Allah and Somali words appeared, wanting to see it on the pages for themselves. For example, the witch's name, Degder, means long ear in Somali, and an important detail of the Somali story is that she has an unusually long ear. The students all exclaimed over the drawings of the witch and her long ear. While children's books often include such portmanteau-esque names and words, the reaction to seeing it done with their native language was completely different from seeing it in English, which draws no reaction. Their excitement at seeing Allah in the book was truly special. When I first read the sentence, it took a second for it to register with the girls. As it began to click, audible, disbelieving murmurs of "Allah," and "Did she say Allah?" ran throughout them, and each wanted to see for themselves where it was written on the page. Even the location of the story was excitingly familiar to some of the students, who said it was where they had come from. I have volunteered in elementary schools before, assisting weekly in a second grade classroom in my hometown of Carmel, New York. The classroom was largely composed of white, middle-class students, many of whom likely attend church regularly, as Carmel has a strong Roman Catholic community. But while the children all thoroughly enjoyed story time, clever names and God earned absolutely no special recognition the way they did for the girls at Northside Learning Center. It was truly the embodiment of why representation matters. Students also enjoyed the physical activity. They probably had the most fun with the witch impressions, but they enjoyed being able to jump around and be silly, eventually tiring themselves out and wanting to just sit and listen. I did not anticipate the level of interest in the story over getting to move around, but I would attribute it to reading a Somali story to which they could connect. A number of months have passed since I did my first reading activity with the girls at Northside Learning Center. Since then, I have continued to spend a great deal of time getting to know them and reading with them, both individually and in groups. I've brought culturally representative books every chance I get. They love Somali folk tales, and they love seeing characters and pictures of authors who look like them. They love seeing their religion in a children's book and the foods they eat and clothes they wear. It's not hard to engage in a story you can relate to. I remember a moment with one particular student, Anab. We were reading a book called Through My Eyes by Tammy Wilson. Anab looked up at me with uncertain eyes, the way she always did when we came to a word she was unsure of. Usually, I would help her sound it out, but my surprise with the word in question got the better of me. Sambusa, I said out loud. Her eyes flickered with recognition and excitement. Oh, sambusa, she said. I love sambusas. That was one of the moments in which it hit me. I had chosen the book because it was about a young Somali girl whose family is resettled in the U.S. The girl on the cover looked like her, and her story was similar to Anab's. I thought perhaps the story would resonate and engage. It did, in many ways. She loved it, and we read chapters upon chapters every Friday night. But any time we came across a word that reflected her Somali culture, be it a food or a name or a holiday, things that I know she could talk about, she couldn't read it. Most of the kids aren't literate in their first language, and when they are taught English, they are not taught with materials that reflect the life and culture they know. So they lack the ability to read and write about their world because they cannot spell it out. For reasons of empowerment alone, it seems that this should change. But beyond that, it seems likely to me that the ability to better learn English is tied to the ability to express oneself in it. That it must be very difficult to draw analogies between one's own experiences and the new culture and society one enters, if one cannot fully express themselves within the new language. We conflate the learning of English with the learning of America, and thus expect these children to learn a new world through a new language, without ever giving them their bearings by teaching the new language through the lens of familiar. I plan to continue volunteering at Northside Learning Center and do my best to contribute to the students' education through engaging, representative stories.